Before we start, I want to thank Rafal and Sharon Almond for once again sponsoring the shiur this evening in memory of Rafal's grandfather, Oscar Almond, Rav Tzadok Barav Moshe Zal. The Shama should have an aliyah. We should have an occasion to celebrate happy occasions, and we should be blessed with long life and good health. Thank you.
Amen. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Dr. Sokolov, Bavakasha, I think we're sort of moving on to a new subject, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, but did you make me?
I made you.
Okay. All right. Okay, so...
made our way through the subjects of the authorship of the constituent books of Tanakh, the canonization, the process by which these 24 individual works of ancient Jewish literature were put together and declared to be Kitvei Kodesh, holy scriptures. And then we spoke about the text itself, the Masoretic text, the change of alphabets as affecting the consonantal text, and the development of signs that indicate vocalization, the pronunciation, and accentuation, the punctuation. So now that we have the consonantal and vocalic text of 24 books that are considered altogether to be Kitvei Kodesh, we can get to the question of, so what does it mean? So we move into the next subject, which is Parshanut HaMikra, or as the proper English term is, exegesis. And for those of you who think that, maybe it's an appropriate name for something that comes up between December 25th and January 1st, so I just put down on the screen that it's actually an anglicization, so to speak, of a Greek word. In Greek, the root of the word means to interpret. Its etymology is in to lead or to guide, but it was used particularly to signify leading or guiding somebody through a text in order to interpret it and to understand it. So we begin this evening on the subject of Parshanut HaMikra. And what I want to do this evening is to look at Parshanut, at biblical, save us all the trouble and call it interpretation or biblical commentary, to look at it from a macro perspective. That is, to look at it from above without getting yet into the specifics of any one individual's contributions to the subject of biblical commentary or interpretation. So I basically divided this into a series of subjects based on what I think is a reasonable assumption of what biblical interpretation is supposed to do. What do you expect from a biblical commentary? If somebody says that they have the capacity, the ability to interpret the Bible, what are the kinds of dispositions, knowledge, skills, or dispositions do you expect them to bring to the task? So this is not obviously an exhaustive catalog, but I think it's reasonably representative. So in order, these are the subjects that we're going to look at this evening, and each one will be illustrated with one or several excerpts from existing Bible commentaries. So this evening is kind of like a potpourri. There'll be selections from some of the earliest Bible commentators, such as Saadia Gaon in the 9th century and 10th century, to Rashi in the 11th century, as well as throughout the Middle Ages, and as recently as the late chief rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Cook, and even perhaps more recently than that. So the purpose this evening is not, as I say, to focus on any individual or any school of biblical commentary, but it's rather, as it were, to sketch out the outer limits or dimensions of what biblical commentary is all about. And for that, I start with the subject of attitude towards authority, or if you wish, intellectual integrity. What do Bible commentators think about their predecessors? Do they regard their predecessors as, old timers, people who may have been okay in their own era, but whose contributions are no longer valid? What do they think about their own weaknesses or disadvantages? Do they ever admit to error? The second subject is the attitude towards Agadah, which really writ large is the attitude towards the sages. But I'm focusing here on one particular aspect of rabbinic lore, and that is Agadah, the non-halachic portion of Talmudic literature and of Midrashic literature. Another thing that we expect of Bible interpreters is obviously a knowledge of Hebrew, but what knowledge do they have or what use do they make of other Semitic languages? As we've already noted, in terms of observing the transition from the ancient Hebrew alphabet to the current Hebrew alphabet, the ancient Hebrew alphabet was shared by the Phoenicians. It was shared by other people who lived in the Middle East during the biblical period. So if the Jews knew that their own alphabet was one that was common to other peoples in the Middle East, then surely there were also similarities in their languages and in their literatures. So along with the knowledge and use of other Semitic languages comes the question of a knowledge of ancient Near Eastern literature. Now, admittedly, not much was known about ancient Eastern literature in the Middle Ages. Our knowledge of ancient Near Eastern literature is barely 200 years old. Most of what we know, if not all of what we know of ancient Near Eastern literature, basically is no older than Champollion, who, if you remember, was part of Napoleon's army. So that's really the very earliest decades of the 19th century. So as I said, it's barely 200 years old, but we will yet see that there are certain indications. Mutuality or exclusivity relates to the question of whether we expect everything in the Bible to be uniquely Jewish, or whether it's conceivable that there are things, important things in the Bible, that are shared with other ancient Near Eastern people. The subject of archaeology is very much central to the proper understanding of the Bible. And yet I'm sure you know, without my having to elaborate it on it, that there are, particularly in the Orthodox world and the so-called ultra-Orthodox world, they take a very dim view of archaeology. Is there any evidence from the classic Bible commentaries as to what they thought of the subject? Literary sensitivity. More and more over the last generation, even non-Jewish Bible scholars have pretty much taken to examining the Bible from literary perspectives. Is that something that is novel, or can we find a sensitivity to the Bible as literature even in earlier Bible commentaries? And finally, back to the subject that we've been pursuing over the last few weeks, what is their view towards the reliability of the Masoretic text? Modern Bible scholars, if they have a problem in a biblical text, as likely as not, will suggest an emendation, a correction. Do we find that at all amongst traditional commentaries? Or is their view of the Masoretic text different from that of the moderns? So with that, we start with the first subject, which is, what do we see amongst the classic Bible commentators in terms of their attitude towards authority, that is, towards their predecessors? And what indications do we have of their own intellectual integrity? So we begin here with a passage from the commentary on the Torah of Rashbam. Rashbam, whom we will get to know more about later on, was the grandson of Rashi. Okay, the letters Rashbam stand for Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir. Meir was one of Rashi's sons-in-law. Probably no, right? This is legendary that Rashi had no sons. He had only daughters. But Rashi saw that his daughters were married to Talmidei Chachamim, to scholars. And surely this Meir was one of those scholars. And in fact, his children, Shmuel, one of them, Yaakov, another, was actually known as Rabbeinu Tam, who was the foremost rabbinic authority in France and Germany after Rashi, his grandfather. So, but Rabbeinu Tam did not, at least to our knowledge, write a commentary on the Torah, while his brother Shmuel did. So here is an excerpt from Shmuel ben Meir's commentary. It happens to be here apropos of Bereshit Perek Lamed Zayin Pasuk Aleph, Vayeshev Yaakov Bi'eretz Megurei Aviv Bi'eretz Kena'an. But to be perfectly honest, this comment has absolutely nothing to do with that verse. And in fact, its situation here, its location here, is quite problematic. But then again, so is the entire commentary on the Torah of Rashbam. Witness the fact that this commentary no longer exists in manuscript. And the sole surviving manuscript on which the printed edition is based seems to have been destroyed or disappeared during the Holocaust. But the mere fact that only one manuscript of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah survived the Middle Ages itself, as Rashi would say, Ein hamikra hazeh omer ela dor sheni, that this fact requires interpretation. And we'll have more to say about that when we get to Rashbam. We're going to, after this evening, we're going to make our way through some of the leading classic medieval and modern commentators in chronological order. So obviously, Rashbam will have to follow after his grandfather, Rashi. Okay, what does Rashbam have to say here? This is part of a very lengthy comment that Rashbam makes, which would be more appropriate if it were the introduction to his commentary on the Torah. But as part of that lengthy prefatory or introductory remark, he says as follows, V'harishonim, the ancients, or my predecessors, mitoch hasidutam, on account of their piety, nit'asku lintot acharei hadirashot she'en ikar. They preoccupied themselves with legal hermeneutics. That is to say that they focused their attention primarily, if not exclusively, on halachic matters. Umitoch kach, and as a result of this preoccupation with the halachic quotient of the Torah, lo hurgelu ba'omek pshuto shel mikra. They did not develop a methodology, says Rashbam. Or literally, it says they did not accustom themselves to what Rashbam calls omek pshuto shel mikra, the depths of pshat of a biblical verse, the most profound and yet straightforward meaning of a Torah text. He then gives a few details. He explains the rationale behind this preoccupation with the legal portions of the Torah. L'fish amru chachamim atarbu b'neichem b'higayon, v'gam amru haoseg b'mikra midah v'ena midah, haoseg b'talmud ein lecha midah gdola mizel, citing a couple of Talmudic aphorisms that are understood to be in praise of Talmud study as being preferable to the study of Tanakh, right? He then repeats, mitoch kach, that on account of this preoccupation, lo hurgulu kol kach bipshutan shel mikraot. They paid their attention primarily to the halachic portions of the Torah. Therefore, they did not develop a methodological approach to its narrative portions. Okay. Now skip down to the fourth line from the bottom, where it says, Va'af ani Shmuel Brabi Meir Chatanozatza, that I, Shmuel, son of Meir, who was the son-in-law of Rashi, right, says this grandson about his grandfather, Nitvakachti imo, that I would debate him. Ulafanav, right? And even person to person, okay? Vahodali. And the grandson Rashbam says of his grandfather Rashi that he admitted to me, She'ilu hayalo pnai, that if he only had the time, Hayat Sarich La'asot Perushim Acherim, he would need to compose new interpretations, Lefi HaPishatot HaMitchadishim B'chol Yom, in light of new insights into the pshat, into the straightforward meaning of the text that can be discovered every day. So, according to Rashbam then, we do not have the best commentary on the Torah of which Rashi was capable. What we have is the only copy, the only commentary on the Torah for which Rashi had the time. Meaning that on the numerous occasions on which Rashbam disputes Rashi's commentary and differs from it, Rashbam would have us understand that his grandfather, can't guarantee it, but Rashbam would have us understand that his grandfather might in fact have said, Taka, meaning he would have said, you know something, Shmuel, you're probably right. And in fact, there is evidence of this because there are a series of biblical verses that all treat the same poetic phenomenon that Rashi himself tended to refer to them as Psukei Shmuel, acknowledging that his understanding of this biblical poetic structure was due to some interpretation that his grandson had shared with him. Ramban, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, who lived in Spain in the middle of the 13th century, and who writes of Rashi in his own introduction to his own commentary, and we will spend some time with Ramban as well, calls Rashi the beacon that I will follow in my own Torah commentary. And yet, despite the fact that he had this appreciation for Rashi, as he says here, Hare Harav, the master, referring to Rashi, Otsar Balum Litorah Lahalachot Ulahagadot, that Rashi is like a treasure trove of Torah knowledge, of halachic knowledge, and of agadot, of rabbinic lore. Nevertheless, Ramban says, Ishtmitate, there is something that escaped his attention. Rashi gave a certain interpretation of the verse here in Bimidbar, Perek Lamed Bet, Pasuk Mem Bet, where Rashi seems to have overlooked a rabbinic source that Ramban is certain he should have known. So again, like Rashbam, Ramban too, as much as he acknowledges his debt to Rashi, was ready, if necessary, to be critical of Rashi if he had adequate reason. So did Rabbi Yeshayahu of Trani, one of the Baalei HaTosafot, and one of the, we call them in general, they're the school of Rashi that continued his work in France and in Germany throughout the 12th and 13th centuries, writes in one of his responsa, "Ki matzati bidavar ze katuv la more rashi dvarim she'en ru'uyim lehit apek leva al nefesh milahashiv alehem." He informs his correspondent that he has found in Rashi's writings something that a person of integrity cannot ignore and must comment on. Meaning, he too believed that he had found something in which Rashi had been in error. And he notes at the bottom, "Ein chacham ba'olam sheyinake min hashigiot." There is no wise person who is entirely error-free. "Ki hachochma einat mima ki im lashem levado." Because only God's wisdom is perfect. And moreover, he makes this very wry observation that I'm sure we all can relate to something of our own acquaintance. "Kifi ma'alat hechacham gidola." To the extent that the stature of a sage is great, "kach ta'ale al yado shkia gedola." To that same extent, he is prone to error. Kemo shamru razal, and he quotes again a rabbinic adage, "lufum churpa shabeshta," that shabeshta, error, is proportionate to churpa, is proportionate to the acuity or sharpness of someone's intellect. Now, it's not just Rashi's successors who are jumping on him and saying, "Ha, ha, 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 Rashi made an error." Rashi himself was not afraid to acknowledge either an error or a change of mind. Here we have a citation. It's not the only one, but it's the most pronounced one. From Rashi's commentary in the book of Yechezkel, where he writes, apropos of a particular interpretation, "Ze yamim rabim sheperashti parasha zo kaasher katuv lema'ala," that some time has passed since I gave the explanation that you see in front of you of this verse. "Achshav," now, however, in going over it, "ani ro'eh b'shinu l'shanot sheba," I see it differently. And in one of his responsa, he writes, "ani kvar nish'alti azeh kama shanim," that I was asked the same question several years ago, "v'hashivoti k'divrei ha'omer yesh hekev," and my response was to agree with somebody who said something about, he's talking here about the hakafot that we do on Sukkot, okay? And then he comes right out and says, "Vishagiti ba," that my previous answer to this question was in error. And not only does he acknowledge an error, look what he says: "Yiyasher kocho shel achi shel amadeti mipilpulo." He gives a yashakoyach, congratulations, to someone he calls his brother. And Rashi says that he himself was informed, educated by this person's pilpul, by this person's analysis of the subject. And this person we're able to identify, his name was Shema'aya, and he wasn't Rashi's brother. He was one of Rashi's students. Parenthetically, he happens to have been that one of Rashi's students who was the first one, probably, to produce a text of all of the things that Rashi had said on the Torah and that we now call Rashi's commentary. He seems to have been Rashi's secretary for a certain amount of time. But here, as I said, not only does Rashi have the integrity to admit mistake, but he's willing to acknowledge that he learned from one of his own students. And just kind of to sum it up, here is a statement on biblical interpretation from the 20th century, actually a second half of the 20th century religious Bible scholar in Israel, Yehuda Elitzur, the author and editor of the Dat Mikra series and an author of several of its commentaries, who wrote as follows. Every exegete is eclectic, but it says that he borrows, right? And summative, right? That he repeats things that other people had said before, yet also an innovator who argues with his predecessors. Just as Rashi diverges from the interpretations of Chazal of the sages, so did his own students and heirs diverge from the bounds of his exegesis, as we've seen. A contemporary exegete is required, of course, to examine things in the light of our knowledge of linguistics, history, reality, archaeology, geography, and all branches of human knowledge. If he does so, then he is following in the path of the ancients, even if he disagrees with them in a thousand details. However, one who copies the words of our predecessors while ignoring the facts that have been discovered and the knowledge that has been revealed in our days is abandoning the ways of the ancients and rebelling against them. And that takes us to a related subject, an attitude towards Agadah. Did the medieval and modern Bible commentators feel that if something was written in the Talmud or written in a Midrash, it's got to be so? Not necessarily. And here is the definitive statement on the subject, courtesy of Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra, a Spanish-born Parshan, biblical commentator of the 12th century. His commentary here is apropos of a verse that we will get to in a couple of months, towards the ends of Sefer Shmot, in the Sidra of Terumah, where there is a list of things that the Israelites were invited to contribute to the construction of the Mishkan. And one of the things on that shopping list, so to speak, are atzei shittim, shittim trees. Whether shittim trees are a variety of cedar, most English translations render them as acacia trees. Ibn Ezra has a different question. Ibn Ezra says that they're amongst our predecessors, and he's referring to the Midrash, who maintain that these shittim trees that the Israelites used in the construction of the Mishkan were brought to Egypt by the patriarch Yaakov, who planted them there. And at the time of the Exodus, Moses instructed the Israelites to take the shittim trees along with them, somehow realizing that they would need them in the construction of the Mishkan. And Ibn Ezra finds this perplexing. Why? He says as follows. The Egyptians thought that the Israelites were only going on a three-day furlough. They had requested permission to leave the city in order to offer sacrifices to God, and then they said they were going to return. In fact, it was on the basis of the assumption that they were only going for 3 days and returning that the Egyptians were prepared to lend them their jewelry and their fine clothing. So Ibn Ezra asked the following question. What were they going to do when they got to the border and the customs inspectors said to them, why are you carrying shittim trees? If the customs inspectors stopped them and said, why are you carrying gold and silver jewelry, they could say, because it's a religious festival and we get all dressed up. Okay? But how would they explain that they were carrying shittim trees? And it's not as though they had chopped it up and they could say, oh, it's kindling for the fires that we need on the altar. In order for these shittim trees to be built into the Mishkan, they had to be, each one had to be 10 cubits long. They had to be between 15 and 20 feet long. And some of them, the ones that served as the crossbars, were even longer than that. So, says Ibn Ezra, what would they have answered to the question, why are you carrying acacia trees if you're only going on a 3-day furlough? And here, apropos of this, Ibn Ezra formulates one of the most outspoken, clear and outspoken methodological critiques of Agada. And he says, "V'hine lo yada'anu." We are in a quandary. Im kabalahi biyad avotenu shemi mitzrayim hotziyom. If this assumption that the shittim trees were grown in Egypt and were removed at the time of the Exodus, if this is a Kabbalah, then says Ibn Ezra, gam anachnu nasur el mishma'atam. Then he says, well, as much as I have reason to question it, if it is a Kabbalah, I will take it at face value. What's a Kabbalah? The word Kabbalah in the 12th century had not yet come to mean what it is means today. It has nothing to do with Jewish mysticism. The word Kabbalah is simply the obverse side of the coin whose other side is Masoret. It means a tradition. And a tradition can be looked upon by the older generation that hands it down and they call it a Masoret. Or it can be seen from the perspective of the younger generation, which receives it, in which case the same thing is called a Kabbalah. So when Ibn Ezra says, if this notion that the shittim trees grew in Egypt is a Kabbalah, what Ibn Ezra means effectively, if it's a historical fact, meaning if the rabbi in the Midrash who said it because that's what his teacher told him, and his teacher told him that because that's what his teacher told him. And we could theoretically trace the chain of transmission all the way back until we got to somebody who said, what a question. I had it on my own shoulders, right? If that's what it is, says Ibn Ezra, then as much as it seems to lack logical consistency, what do? Historical facts are historical facts. I would say parenthetically, then I'm sure that many, most, maybe even all of us have in our own lifetimes experienced such things. If a day before the Berlin Wall was knocked down, somebody had told you they're going to knock down the Berlin Wall tomorrow, you would have said, don't be ridiculous, right? And yet, 24 hours later, it was gone. So things that appear illogical, nevertheless, are historical. So Ibn Ezra says that if this were to be proven to be an historical fact, then in spite of his criticism of it, he would accept it. On the other hand, says Ibn Ezra, we're unable to determine whether it's an historical fact. In which case, he says, the same statement, namely that the shittim trees were planted in Egypt, must be regarded as a sivara. Sivara means that it's somebody's individual opinion. And if it's only an individual opinion, says Ibn Ezra, yesh levakesh derech acheret, then we are free to seek an alternative. And the alternative that Ibn Ezra provides in this case, the alternative to the shittim trees having been carried out of Egypt, is that adjacent to Mount Sinai, there was a grove of acacia trees. We find the same basic methodological formulation even in Rashi. Apropos of a particular Agadah that is used in conjunction with a verse in Bimidbar, Perek Kafav, Pasuk Kafdalet, Rashi says, Im Agadah hi haretov. I understand Rashi to be using the word Agadah in the very sense that Ibn Ezra used Kabbalah, meaning this statement sounds odd, but if it's part of a chain of transmission, that's what the word Agadah means, right? The word Agadah is the same, it means the same thing as the word Haggadah spelled with a hey. Literally, it simply means higid. It's something that one person tells another. So Rashi too says that if this, whatever this interpretation is, turns out to be part of an unbroken chain of oral transmission, then says Rashi, Tov, fine and dandy. However, he says, if im lav, but if it's not an Agadah, but it is what Ibn Ezra calls a Sivara, then says Rashi, Omer Ani, I can give you an alternative interpretation. And here in Yosef Karav, who was another one of Rashi's direct students, right? Somebody who sat in Rashi's Tanakh classes, okay? We find one of the most, perhaps, extreme rejections of Agadah. In one case, in his commentary on Shofetim, he says, it is not customary for a prophet of any one of the 24 canonical books to speak so enigmatically, right? He says, nowhere in Tanakh do we need an Agadah in order to understand something. No prophet would have deliberately been so opaque, so obtuse, as to leave us without any idea of what he was saying unless we had an Agadah. And in the case of his commentary on Shmuel Aleph, he says, Kol mi sheino yodea pshuto shel mikra, anyone who does not understand or does not labor to understand the simple understanding of a biblical text, and instead notelo achar midrasho shel davar, and instead inclines towards the Agadah, towards the Midrash, what can be compared to, he says, domeleze sheshtafatu shibolet nahar, he can be compared to somebody who was overwhelmed by a gigantic wave, umaamke mayim mitzifim, and is submerged in deep waters, v'ochez kol asher ya'alev yado lehinatzel, and who seizes any piece of flotsam or jetsam to keep his nose above water. Agadah, then, according to Yosef Kara, is the last resort. That moves us along to the subject of languages other than Hebrew. Needless to say, which of course is why I'm saying it, but why there is no slide for it, Aramaic is a biblical language along with Hebrew. And we know that certainly the medieval and the modern rabbinic commentators on the Bible certainly had an understanding and a knowledge of Aramaic because of their extensive and intensive Talmudic studies. Nonetheless, again, courtesy of Ibn Ezra, we find the following comment. It's actually an addendum. It's tacked on to the end of his commentary on Shir HaShirim, in which Ibn Ezra says to the reader of his commentary, you may wonder why throughout this commentary on Shir HaShirim have I been using so many comparisons between Hebrew and Arabic, which he calls Lashon Yishmael. And he explains that it is Ba'avur Kotzer Da'atenu. It's a consequence, as Ibn Ezra, of our ignorance. What are we ignorant of? He explains, Ki lo neda milshon hakodesh, ki ma katuv bimikra shehutzrichu hanaviim ledaber. Our knowledge of biblical Hebrew is limited to the Bible. And the Bible is limited to those things, to the records of those things that the prophet spoke about. Umashalo hutzrichu, but something that a prophet had no need to talk about, lo neda shema, we're ignorant of it. Do we know how people in the Bible ordered breakfast? Do we even really know in the Bible how people greeted each other? There's one instance in the Bible where there's a greeting, right? It's very famous. Anybody who's ever been a member of Bnei Akiva knows it, right? How do you greet people? You say, Hashem imachem, right? And the response is, Yivarechecha Hashem. Where do you get that from? You get it from the one place in the Bible, right, in the book of Ruth, where somebody greets Boaz by saying, Hashem, Boaz greets his field workers by saying, Hashem imachem, and they reply to him, Yivarechecha Hashem. So Ibn Ezra's point is that our knowledge of biblical Hebrew is limited to those things that the prophets needed to address, but some subject that may have been so trivial that no prophet ever needed to address it, we have absolutely no idea what it is. or a subject which they may have addressed only once and not in sufficient detail for us to understand it. Therefore, says Ibn Ezra, Babur hayot l'shon Yishmael karov ma'od l'shon HaKodesh, that due to the similarities between Hebrew and Arabic, and he delineates some of those similarities, right? Conjugations of the verb, verbal forms for passive, reflexive, noun, cause, etc. He says as follows, Al Kain, fourth line from the bottom, Kol mila shelo nimtza l'chaver b'mikra, any word in the Bible which we don't understand because it appears only once, and the context is insufficient for us to determine exactly what it is, v'yesh domeh b'lshon Yishmael, and there is an identical word in the Arabic language whose meaning we know with greater precision, then says Ibn Ezra, nomar ulai perusha kein, then we will suggest that perhaps the biblical Hebrew word has the same meaning as the word in Arabic. But here Ibn Ezra is even more cautious than contemporary Semitists. Contemporary Semitists, if they find a word in Ugaritic or a word in Akkadian and a similar word in Hebrew, they jump and they say, ah, that's it. Ibn Ezra is more cautious and he says, afa pi shahadavar b'safek. He still understands that in spite of all of these similarities, Arabic and Hebrew are nevertheless two different languages. And therefore, the fact that the word means something in Arabic is not an absolute guarantee that it has the same meaning in Hebrew. No question in my mind that if Ibn Ezra were living in the 20th century and had access to Ugaritic and to Akkadian and to other ancient Semitic languages, he would have gladly used them. Same really goes for ancient Near Eastern literature. As I pointed out, ancient Near Eastern literature is really a product of the 19th and 20th centuries. There really was no ancient Near Eastern literature known previously outside of the Bible. The Mesopotamian epics of creation and the epic of Gilgamesh and the Ugaritic northern Canaanite epics of creation, the Baal epics, etc., were totally unknown before the era of archaeology. But there's something similar. And here we have Moshe Ibn Ezra, may or may not have been a relative of Abraham Ibn Ezra. He was slightly older. And his expertise was more in the field of poetry than in the field of Parshanut. Nevertheless, writes as follows. In citing the Arabic Quran, I've paid no attention to the opposition adopted by certain opinions among the halachists of our generation, meaning he knows that his use of the Quran in explaining Jewish things was rejected by many Jewish authorities. Okay. However, he says, I've seen that the greatest halachists and philosophers, and he names two of them, Rabbeinu Saadia Gaon of the 10th century, Rabbeinu Haya Gaon of the 11th century, relied on it, on the Quran, when seeking assistance in elucidating obscurities in prophetic literature. Meaning again, like Ibn Ezra, if there was a difficult word in Sefer Yeshayahu, or difficult phrase, and there was a similar phrase in Arabic, right? Saadia Gaon, Rav Haya Gaon would bring that to people's attention. In fact, he says, they even used Christian commentaries to try to explain difficult things in Tanakh. And certainly Rambam. In the Moreh Nevuchim, Rambam says that the knowledge of pagan attitudes and activities, things that we know more about today because of our greater knowledge of ancient Near Eastern literature, Rambam had an intuitive understanding of these things. He also had something that was called the Book of Agriculture, which was believed to be a work of ancient Near Eastern literature, but it most probably was a medieval forgery. Nevertheless, Rambam says that a knowledge of pagan attitudes and activities is a prime source for providing the rationales of mitzvot. It's important for the subject of Tamei HaMitzvot. Why? Because the basis of our entire Torah and the axis on which it rotates is the elimination of those attitudes from our thoughts and of those traces from existence. Why does the Torah prohibit the cooking of milk and meat together? Rambam suggests because this was a contemporary pagan practice that the Torah found particularly abominable. So clearly, if Rambam had known more and more authentically about the literature of the ancient Near East and would then have been able to extrapolate the attitudes and beliefs of ancient Near Eastern people, he would have used more of it. And that raises the question, as I said, of, but can there really be things in Tanakh and in the ancient Near East that are the same? So the definitive statement on this must come from the 20th century, as I said, because prior to that, there really wasn't that much known about the ancient Near East. So here we have a statement on the subject by the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of the of mandatory Palestine, Rabbi Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, who writes as follows. Is it not well known that among the ancients, there were people who knew of God? Prophets, spiritual giants, Metushala, Chanoch, Shem, Aver. Right? Is it conceivable that they had no impact on their contemporaries? Of course, he says, they were eclipsed by the activities of Avraham. But otherwise, he says, how could their influence have left no impression at all? Their works, the works of such people as Metushala, Chanoch, Shem, Aver, right? the outstanding characters of the early, you know, biblical eras, their works must have resembled those of the Torah because they were inspired by the same God. Now, as I said, archaeology too is something that did not exist before the 19th century, right? Heinrich Schliemann's excavation of Troy was the very first instance of an archaeological dig. And yet, we have indications. And here's the indication. The indication comes to us courtesy of Ramban. You may know that Ramban went on Aliyah. As a result, immediately, primarily, if not immediately, his success in defending Judaism in an infamous disputation that took place in Barcelona in 1263, Ramban, Spain was like too hot for him. So he left Spain and he went to the land of Israel. In those days, if you took a ship to the land of Israel, you would land in the port of Akko. And Ramban wrote this as follows, that in Akko, he found in the possession of the elders of the Jewish community there, an engraved silver coin, Matbea Kesef Mifutach, an engraved silver coin. On one side of the coin was a flowering staff, Makel Shaked. On the other side of the coin, there was a tzinsenet, a vase. And both sides were inscribed. But they were inscribed in the ancient Hebrew alphabet. So what did Ramban do? He took it to somebody who could read the ancient Hebrew alphabet. Who in the land of Israel in the 13th century could read the ancient Hebrew alphabet? There was no Hebrew university yet, right? He took it to the Kutiyim. The Kutiyim are the Samaritans. You may remember when we were talking about the transition of the alphabets, we were at a passage from the Talmud that said that the original Hebrew alphabet was the Assyrian alphabet and the later Hebrew alphabet. And the punchline was that the rabbinic Judaism chose for itself Ktav Ashuri, the so-called Assyrian alphabet, the square Hebrew script that has been used for the last 2,000 years or more, and they left the ancient Hebrew alphabet for the Samaritans. So knowing that the Samaritans still use the ancient Hebrew alphabet in the 13th century, Ramban brought the coin to them, and they read the coin, and they said that one inscription was Shekel Hashkalim, and the inscription on the other side was Yerushalayim HaKedosha. Ramban didn't bring it to the Samaritans because they were paragons of Jewish religious virtue. He brought the coin to them because it was utilitarian. It worked because they could read it. I suspect that today, too, Ramban might not go out himself on an archaeological dig, but would not be opposed to using an archaeological find. As I said again in the introduction, in the contemporary period, and certainly in the 21st century, and even for a great deal of the end of the 20th century, the emphasis on biblical study amongst Jews and non-Jews alike has been literary. But this too is not a novelty. Saadia Gaon in the 10th century already wrote, "It is inescapable that all words will be either univocal, having only one meaning, or equivocal, having more than one meaning. Why? Since all languages are constructed according to this pattern. So it is with the Torah, since it too was given in a human language." So a recognition again that the Torah, even if the Torah was dictated by God to Moses, Dibra Torah Kilshon B'nei Adam, the words and the literary forms that God used when he dictated the Torah to Moshe were intended to be understood the way people customarily understand literature. Same with Rashi in his introduction to his commentary on Shir HaShirim, citing a verse in Psalms, which is a very critical verse in the Talmud. "God speaks but once, Achad Diber Elohim, yet I hear two messages, Shtayim Zu Shama'ati." The Talmud says, "Katuv Echad Yotze L'chama Ta'amim," a single verse may have several meanings. "Ve'ein l'cha mikra yotze midei pshuto." But in the final analysis, no verse may be denied or purged of its literal sense. And even though the prophets were wont to speak figuratively, afapisha dibru hanevi'im divrehem bidugma, one must settle liyashev et hadugma al ofneha va'al sidra. Rashi understood that metaphors have to be understood in cultural contexts. Give you an example, right? A very simple metaphor, a sweet smile, right? Is a sweet smile good or bad? The answer is a sweet smile is good. What makes a sweet smile a good smile? The fact that we normally associate sweetness with something good. I would imagine that in a society of diabetics, right, a sweet smile might be the equivalent of the kiss of death. So Rashi, too, was aware of and sensitive to the literary quotient of Tanakh. And finally, while again we saw the sources, we saw the Machzor Vitri on the origin of the Masoretic text and its vocalization, we saw the Talmudic Midrashic text addressing the subject of the Masoretic text, right, and its reliability. And yet here we find two 13th, 14th century Bible commentators, both living in Provence, southwestern France, saying as follows. The Radak we've already seen. We saw it last week because it was his explanation of what we called kreuktiv, the fact that certain words are written but not vocalized inside the text, and then they are written and vocalized differently in the margins of the text. That essentially is an acknowledgement of the fallibility of the Masoretic text. The other one, it just happened to be something I was studying myself, is a verse in 2 Chronicles. The way you see it here is the way it appears in the Masoretic text. Vayhi l'drosh Elohim bimei Zechariahu. It's talking about a king of Judea named Asa, who went to seek God during the time of a prophet named Zechariah. Why Zechariah? Because Zechariah was Hamevin Biraot HaElohim, because he had some understanding, some deep understanding of visions of God. And that's very odd, because not every prophet saw visions of God. And what's the connection between visions of God and seeking God? So here we have the commentary of Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershom, which you see in the white box below it, where his citation of the text is Vayhi l'drosh Elohim bimei Zechariahu hamevin, but it doesn't say Bir'ot HaElohim. It says Biyir'at HaElohim. that Asa chose Zechariah to be his religious guide, his guru, so to speak, because Zechariah had the reputation of having a deep understanding of the fear of God. And there's a notation that follows. This notation, I got to tell you, I do not understand. If I knew the address of the editors of the Mikraot Gedolot HaKeter at Bar Ilan University, I would write to them, because this is clearly a marginal note. It doesn't belong in the text of Rabag's commentary. But the truth is that it says, V'chein katuv b'chtav yad, v'chein nimtza b'Yerushalmi. The notation says that this alternate reading of the verse, the one that Rabag prefers, Yirat Elohim, is found in manuscripts, and it's also reflected in a passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi. And furthermore, it says that in Ktuvim Defus Napoli, that it's actually in some printed editions of Tanakh. And not only that, the final proof is V'chein Tirgem HaMitargem, that if you look at the Aramaic Targum of this verse, it translates HaMevin Birot Elohim as the Melitz B'Dechalto Dashem. Dechalto is the Aramaic equivalent of Yirat Elohim, not the equivalent of Ra'ot Elohim. So again, we see that the medievals, at least, were not reluctant. If they thought that there was compelling evidence for it, they were not reluctant to even critique, as it were, the Masoretic text. Okay. Thank you, Rabbi Kellman, but I can now read my own chats. I figured out how to correct it. Okay. Children of Israel that mentioned the 10th meeting before leaving Egypt, that mentions even Egypt Tabernacle. Well, exactly that. See, we'll talk about this more. All right. It will take too long to give the full answer now. I make a note for myself to be sure to discuss this apropos of Rashi. We will, when we talk about Rashi, talk about Rashi's attitude towards Midrash. And we'll see that basically there are two schools of thought. One school of thought says that Rashi only uses Midrash if he's desperate, right? That only if Rashi can't give a pshat interpretation of the verse will he resort to Midrash. Another school of thought says, not necessarily. Rashi can tell you what the verse means according to its pshat, and then he will give you a Midrash for ethical, moral, didactic reasons. Okay? So a quick answer would be that the point of the Midrash is to say, see, when the Israelites built a Mishkan in the wilderness, they were using the trees that their great-great-grandfather Jacob brought to Egypt and planted for them. Remember the Talmudic story about Choni HaMa'agel, right? About who woke up and he found the tree growing that he had planted 70 years earlier. And he said, just as my ancestors planted for me, so am I planting for my descendants, right? So that would be the same idea here. Not that they necessarily knew the dimensions, but that somehow this would be the fulfillment of a patriarchal promise. No, Ibn Ezra never chose his words carefully, and he never had a fear of being accused of heresy. He was. We'll see some even more acerbic comments by Ibn Ezra when we focus on him. I thought they say in Yiddish every word is equivalent. I studied Arabic many years. They say that every word in Arabic means itself and its opposite and a part of the camel. Did Rav Kook believe that Methuselah was a historical figure? Yes, Rav Kook believed that Methuselah was a historical figure and that all of the characters in the Bible were historical figures. If you'd ask me, what proof did he have that Methuselah was a righteous man who would be able to correctly represent the word of God, I would tell you that he had no compelling historical evidence, but I'm imagining that Rabbi Kook thought as follows. Nobody gets to live as long as Methuselah lived unless there is a good reason for it. And the best reason to explain his longevity was that he was a good guy. If you have not had a chance to donate in 2021, and even if you have, you can do so here. Great time for a 2021 tax receipt. I think that speaks for itself.
Okay, there's still one more comment, I think.
Sorry about that.
That was just okay.
Jacob planted. Yeah, I know, that's cute. I mean, that's an interesting op-ed to try to combine both of those traditions. That's a curious one. Apropos of mixing meat with milk, according to the ancient Menuk test, that's okay. I assume you mean those Indians. Okay.
I know we can get to Lo Tevash Shogdi B'Chalevimo. You know, I think it's the Rambam and the Mor Nevuchim talks about he talks in a lot of it about the historical influence, why exactly the Torah uses that example and what it means. But okay, that's detailed Parshanut. But okay, thank you very much. Okay, we'll look forward to next week. As I mentioned at the beginning, tomorrow morning at 11 a.m., 11 a.m. Eastern, Mark Trencher will be giving a series. He's the founder and the one of Nishman. He's actually a professional statistician. I think he was a professor of mathematics. And he, that's for the last number of years, he's been doing these, sociological studies of the Orthodox world. Nishma research, you can go online. Some of them are quite fascinating. So he'll be talking tomorrow on the state of Orthodoxy, modern Orthodoxy, more specifically, whatever that means. And that's self-defined. And then he'll be talking next week on the finances of the Orthodox world. So that, I think they're very fascinating sociological studies and that we look forward to learning too. And then the Parsha tomorrow night and then Siddur on Friday morning and Dr. Sokolov next week. And Rabbi Liebtag will be finishing his series on 7 this Sunday. This will be the last of the series. And then we have a couple interesting classes next week too. And then the week after we'll start with our winter series, which is just about ready to be finalized, but not 100% yet. So keep your eyes out for that. And we look forward to learning to invite a friend for 2022, also for 2021. But as we start the new year, if we may, I know, listen, Arba Rosh Hashanah Haim. That's what the first mission of Rosh Hashanah says. So we have Rosh Hashanah, but I don't have to tell you, the year end, we who live in America, that's how we work. I'll just end with Rav Tabori. I remember when we were in high school told us, he would quote us the Gemara that Jews in Chutz Laaretz are of the Avodah Zarah B'Tahara. We worship idolatry and purity. You can't live here and not be influenced by the environment and Santa Claus and Christmas carols. And we all know the tunes and most of them were written by Jews anyway. But whatever, that's the way life is here. And of course, our whole tax season works December 31st. So we can always, it's always a good time to make a New Year resolution. I hope, okay, enough of that. Everybody knows what I mean. Laila Tov, everybody be well, and look forward to seeing you next week. And thank you again to the Almonds for their sponsorship. Okay. Yeah, I guess it's always a good time to wish people that. Why not? That's some people say, B'chol Yom, every day God judges us. It's not so clear we're only judged Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, but that requires a whole other shir. But okay, Laila Tov, everybody. And
thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Sokolov.
You're very welcome. Thank you.